Now we want to go a little deeper on news that broke earlier this week that the World Health Organization has added cell phones to its long list of possible causes of cancer. Now, cell phones are so much a part of people's lives that we just had to ask NPR's Eliza Barkley to talk to us about what she wrote regarding the WHO conclusions. She wrote about this for NPR's health blog called Shots. She's a web producer on NPR Science Desk, and she's with us now in our Washington, D.C. studio. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, obviously, this is a cause of great concern to people. It's very attention-getting. Cell phones, I mean, are ubiquitous these days. In fact, many people use a cell phone who don't even have a landline anymore. So you can see why people are very concerned about this. So just briefly, as you can, tell us, what's the recommendation?
Well, what the WHO is saying is that based on some very limited scientific evidence that they have, there may be some cause for concern that cell phones could cause cancer, but they don't really know.
What is the reason behind this concern?
They've looked at a couple of recent studies, and while none of these studies actually proved that cell phones cause cancer, there were a couple of groups, and in particular, these are people who are long-term heavy users of cell phones, people who talk on their phone 30 minutes a day for more than 10 years. Within that particular group, there was some increased risk for certain kinds of brain tumors specifically.
What exactly was the data that they looked at?
Well, what they did was they talked to people who had brain tumors, and then they asked them about their cell phone use. But the thing is, with this kind of research, it's very hard to prove that it was the cell phones in people's lives that had actually caused the cancer, right? There are so many environmental factors that can contribute to cancer. And a lot of scientists said that these studies were, in fact, flawed and inconclusive, because how can you really know that it was the cell phone?
I mean, I think everybody knows that the use of cell phones has increased exponentially, you know, worldwide in recent years. Has the incidence of brain cancer also increased?
No, it hasn't really. And so that should be a pretty clear indication that it's hard to draw a strong correlation between cell phones and brain cancer.
What would be the possible link?
Well, cell phones emit a kind of radiation. It's a low-level type of radiation. But the thing is, this radiation is not the kind of radiation that damages DNA and causes mutations that can lead to cancer. It's not the same as radiation, for example, from X-rays. It's closer to radiation from microwaves.
If the data on this is as ambiguous as it seems to be, or as incomplete or as inconclusive, why would the WHO issue this pronouncement now?
Well, they really want more research on this topic. And fortunately, there are a couple of big studies underway right now in the United States and Europe that could help them get to the bottom of this. Remember, this is a really hard thing to study. People haven't been using cell phones for that long. And health researchers like to have a lot of data, years and years, decades if they can get it, before they are really confident about a health trend. Just think about how long it took them to prove that smoking causes cancer.
Is there a specific recommendation that flows from this, even if this information is inconclusive?
Well, you could use your wireless or wired headset, because the cell phone's antenna, that way it wouldn't be next to your head. It would be somewhere else in the body. So that's one possible thing to do. But in general, you know, a lot of researchers are not that concerned about this. And the other thing is that there are billions of people today using cell phones, and they really haven't seen an increase in the type of brain tumor that they're concerned about anywhere.
So what would be the point of announcing this now if the information is as ambiguous as it seems to be?
Well, they want to be cautious. They're saying, we don't yet know enough about this, but we should take a precaution anyway, and we'll consider this as a possible carcinogen, possible being the key word.
So I'm going to put you on the spot. You still using your cell phone? Are you going for your hands-free listening device? I don't want to use a trade name here. Are you biasing toward your hands-free listening device?
Well, it's definitely made me think about it a little bit more, but I'm still using my cell phone just as much as everybody. It's pretty hard to even cut down.
Eliza Barkley is a web producer for NPR's Science Desk. She writes for NPR's health blog called Shots. And if you want to read the piece that she wrote about this issue, we'll link to it on our website. Just go to npr.org, click on the Programs tab, and then on Tell Me More. Eliza, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Flora Lichtman is here with our video pick of the week. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira. This week we have something for our Fun in the Sun series. Ooh. Fun, or maybe this, it would better to say fun with the sun, I think, on this one. it's about the sun. That's the spoiler.
Yeah, that's about the sun. And we had a sun piece on a few weeks ago about what to do with
so
the
you
sun.
Can get, it's continuing ed, really. It's a continuing ed piece. It turns out that scientists are still looking at sunspots. And I say still looking because they're sort of one of the earliest astronauts. I mean, people have been looking at them for 400 years. Galileo was interested in them. Mm-hmm. But they now have bigger telescopes. And a study out this week sort of looks at the anatomy of a sunspot and how the plasma flows within that structure. So just as a little recap, which I needed to do, went back and relearned, the sun is made of hot plasma that's boiling to the surface, that's charged gas.
Right.
And sunspots are formed when you have a magnetic field that comes out of the sun in sort of a vertical way. So that dark spot is where the boiling motion that happens all over the surface of the sun gets interrupted.
Uh-huh.
And so it's a little bit cooler. It's still pretty hot. I mean, it's not like you'd want to hang out there. and then around that black spot, you have right. these sort of stringy things called the penumbra. And this study is about the penumbra.
And on your video, on our video pick of the week up there, sunspots on our website at sciencefriday.com, it's such a beautiful image of a sunspot.
It's really mesmerizing.
It looks like an iris or an eye. And it's just absolutely fascinating.
It's really worth taking a look. Even the scientist I talked to, John Sharmer, said, you know, this stuff is just so fascinating and beautiful to look at. And of course, he looks at it all the time. So,
and it doesn't lose its beauty, Dan.
It has not. I think actually, you know, we were talking earlier about Feynman's pleasure of finding things out. And it seems that, you know, it's sort of taken on new beauty when you understand it better, when you can deconstruct what you're looking at.
Yeah. You know, we can't look at the sun with our naked eyes. We don't want to tell anybody to do that.
Do not do that.
there are ways to look at it through a lens on a piece of paper or something like that.
Right.
You know, you can actually see it on the ground sometimes, speckling through leaves coming through. I've actually seen the sun projected on the ground that way. But it's part of the fascination we have with the sun.
Yeah.
And your video is just beautiful.
Yeah.
Right? It's if nothing else, it's just a beautiful look.
It does
at
have
the
that
sun.
Going.
It's gorgeous, but then learning why it's beautiful is the extra intellectual value.
Yeah, I think you're right. And you know what? That's a good point, that we can't look at it directly, so these views of it seem almost kind of magical because it's something that we are sort of encounter every single day, but these
beautiful
telescopes just give us a new look.
It's our video pick of the week. It's up there on our website at sciencefriday.com, and you can also download it on iTunes as a podcast, a video podcast. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
It's great having you have with another Fun in the Sun.
Fun in the Sun.
Fun in the
if
Sun.
If you have suggestions for other Fun in the Suns,
Send
us an email.
Send them in. That's about it for this hour. Our program's senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata, Catherine Wells, Alessio Bayak. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Ian Chant is our intern. Neil Rausch, our technical director at the controls here in New York. And if you missed any part of our program, if you want to take that sunspot with you, go over to our website at sciencefriday.com. And subscribe to our podcasts, the audio ones and the video ones with the sunspots and stuff in there. And go to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we're tweeting at SciFry, SCIFRI, on Facebook, SciFry, and on our website at sciencefriday.com all week long. I'm Ira Flato in New York.
With a new jobs report showing that hiring has slowed significantly, the White House went on the offensive today. President Obama was in Ohio, arguing that the bailout of Chrysler and General Motors saved thousands of jobs that otherwise would have disappeared. The president visited a Chrysler plant in Toledo, where he announced the government sale of its final 6% stake in Chrysler to Italian automaker Fiat.
So this industry is back on its feet, repaying its debts, gaining ground. Because of you, we can once again say that the best cars in the world are built right here in the U.S. of A., right here in Ohio, right here in the Midwest.
The resurrection of the auto industry is emerging as a theme in President Obama's reelection campaign, and so we called on someone to help us look deeper into this claim that the White House has helped save Detroit. David Shepherdson is a Washington bureau chief for the Detroit News. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Michelle.
Now, is this a fair claim? Is the auto industry indeed out of the woods?
It's certainly out of the woods in the sense that it's going to be around for a while, But no, certainly long term, 5, 10, 15 years from now, the companies are going to have to continue to build products that people want to buy. But these are companies that can now make profits, selling far fewer cars. They're leaner, and they're just in a position to be profitable, even if sales aren't what they were 5 or 10 years ago.
So they're in a position to be profitable. But what we're hearing here is a sort of slowly emerging theme that the White House saved Detroit, saved the auto industry. True?
Both President Bush and President Obama did save the auto industry, no question about it. Remember in 2008, GM and Chrysler were out of money. They were going to collapse, and Congress didn't act. President Bush opted to use $17 billion of TARP money to save General Motors and Chrysler. He basically threw the ball into the president's lap in January, and President Obama opted to put both GM and Chrysler through bankruptcy, add another $60 billion to that bailout, and then restructure those companies in a very quick fashion.
How much did the bailouts and the loan guarantees cost taxpayers? How big a stake does the U.S. still have in these companies? And has that money, or will that money, be recouped?
In the case of Chrysler, government has agreed to sell its remaining stake in the company. As a result, the taxpayers will lose about $1.3 billion of the $12.5 billion invested in Chrysler. At current stock prices, the government would likely lose about $10 billion on the bailout of General Motors. So somewhere in the $14 billion range is what taxpayers ultimately will probably be on the hook for.
Did the bailout actually save jobs and create new ones? Because we heard President Obama today tick through a lot of numbers and a lot of statistics, claiming that these are jobs that might have been lost if they had not showed up with these guaranteed loans. Did they actually create new jobs as well?
Absolutely. March 2009, even the Obama administration is divided. Do we save Chrysler? There was never an argument whether General Motors was going to survive, but Chrysler was in a far weaker position. There's no question that Chrysler would have collapsed. There were no other buyers for the company, and it would have resulted in the loss of tens of thousands of jobs.
So you hail from Detroit. You cover Washington. Right. It sounds like, in listening to you, that the White House is standing on firm ground when they make this claim that they've helped resurrect Detroit. And yet, there are a lot of people who do not agree, who think that the bailouts were a bad idea. They thought it then. They still think it now. And they think what actually saved Detroit was bankruptcy, not bailouts.
Well, right. And well, in fact, of course, GM and Chrysler did ultimately go through bankruptcy. The argument you hear from Republicans is one, that no public money should have been used, that the company should have gone to the private sector. The reality was, in December 2008, no one was going to bail out Detroit except the U.S. government. If this was just about the free market, GM and Chrysler wouldn't exist. The impact to workers, to these struggling states, it meant literally overnight hundreds of thousands of people losing their jobs, not just at Chrysler, at the dealers in every state across the country, at the suppliers.
And the president talked about
right.
that.
Right. And
today.
The president, and I think the president made an interesting point. He went to this plant in Toledo, just where they make the Jeep Wrangler, where they employ 2,000 people. But there's also 3,000 other people at suppliers that are producing parts for that vehicle. So the impact of autos on the economy and the number of jobs is very significant, and it was just too great a risk.
David Shepardson, thanks so much for coming into the studio.
Thanks, Michelle.
That's David Shepardson. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Detroit News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The Ohio State football scandal is prompting new questions that reach far beyond the Buckeyes. The popular coach at Ohio State, Jim Tressel, was forced to resign earlier this week. He knew some of his players broke NCAA rules, but he covered it up. As NPR's Tom Goldman reports, breaking the rules is one of college sport's oldest problems.
Ohio State's immediate future seems as gray as Jim Tressel's famous sweater vest. Tressel's gone. The team's star quarterback, Terrell Pryor, is suspended several games next season for selling memorabilia and receiving improper benefits. Investigators also are looking into how Pryor got the multiple cars he's been driving at the university. Ohio State is college sports' wreck of the moment. Naturally, that means wall-to-wall chatter in the sports media.
Remember this, Woody Hayes had Ohio State on probation in the 1950s and said famously that if his players were hungry, he'd feed them out of his own pocket.
Bomani Jones, here on ESPN's Around the Horn, is one reporter who doubts the scandal's long-term impact.
This has happened before and people will get over it. Watch.
Dust off the history books and you'll discover just how much this has happened before. In 1852, a Harvard versus Yale boat race on Lake Winnipesaukee in New Hampshire was considered the first intercollegiate sporting event. They had a sponsor, the Boston Concord Montreal Railroad, and, says college sports historian and author Murray Sperber, they broke the rules.
Scholars have looked at the records, and a number of rowers were not registered students at the time, or were former students.
It's a long and winding road from Lake Winnipesaukee to Jim Tressel, but Sperber says it's linked together by two powerful forces, amateurism and American-style competitiveness, that have always driven college sports. Unfortunately, says Sperber, in opposite directions.
The structure was set up in almost a British 19th century form, where gentlemen play the game honorably and don't cheat. That model, meeting the American impulse and obsession to win, is just contradictory and has never been resolved. It's like squaring the circle.
The nearly 50 people currently in the NCAA's enforcement division think amateurism, winning, and money can mix with vigilance. The division enforces the NCAA's many rules, way too many critics say, and investigates rule breaking. Julie Rowe Lash is the new vice president of enforcement. She says on-campus monitoring is stronger.
10 years ago, most compliant staffs had one or two people. Now you see anywhere from 5 to 10 at many larger Division I schools.
In the same time frame, Roe Lash says the NCAA has nabbed more rule breakers. More coaches, she says, have been suspended for so-called secondary infractions, which are either isolated or inadvertent violations.
10 years ago, there were about 2,000 secondary cases processed a year, and now there's over 4,000.
Earnest efforts by earnest people. But critics like Murray Sperber simply see, in his words, hamsters on the wheel. How to break the cycle of rule breaking? Sperber's not the first to suggest blowing up college sports and replacing it with a free market system like the pros. No more student athletes, at least in men's basketball and football. It's a long shot at best, considering how much college sports in its current state is part of the fabric of so many communities across the country. There are discussions going on about reform, but within the current structure, which means when it comes to scandal, the operative phrase remains on and on. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Christopher Plummer has been acting for more than half a century. He is 81. He's appeared in more than 100 movies. And no matter what he does, no matter how good he is, and he's often very good, he may always be remembered as a certain Austrian Navy captain named Von Trapp. Well, Christopher Plummer's latest role is extremely memorable. The film is called Beginners, written and directed by Mike Mills. Plummer plays Hal, a retired museum director who comes out as gay after the death of his wife of 45 years. Hal finds a younger boyfriend. He throws parties. He goes to gay dance clubs. It's all very confusing for his adult son, Oliver, who's played by Ewan McGregor. Here, after a night out, Hal calls Oliver.
Oliver?
Yeah?
I'm not sorry I woke you.
I went to Akbar tonight.
You did?
Yeah, oh, they had some wonderfully loud
music. What kind of music's that?
Probably house music.
House music. Okay. House music.
Christopher Plummer's character being informed by his son that the music at the club was called house music. Christopher Plummer, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
This was a fun part, playing Hal?
I adored the part, and I thought it was so well written and so unsentimental and brave and funny and witty and free, yeah. Totally free. I mean, of course, he was so relieved to be able to come out of the closet and in such a happy way because he was so fond of his latest boyfriend. Yeah. I just adored the way it was tackled. It was tackled with such humanity and sweetness and fun.
This character that you play is based on Mike Mills' own father, who I guess
yes.
came out as gay after a long marriage.
Yes.
When you play the part then, do you feel you have to ask the director again, how do you want me to do this? Am I like your father, or is that
no,
simply
when
put
I
aside?
When I realized that it was a true story and that my character was his father, I thought, oh, God, this is going to be awful because, of course, he's going to be at me every 5 seconds. And when I brought this up with Michael, he said, are you kidding? He said, I don't want you to imitate my father, even if you could. He's dead. How could you imitate him? Be you and do what you want.
Now, I want to ask you about recent parts for you in the movies. In the past 10 years or so, since playing Mike Wallace in The Insider and uttering those immortal lines, I don't want to spend the rest of my career wandering in the wilderness of National Public Radio. then in A Beautiful Mind, you seem to have gotten a lot more and a lot better film parts.
Yes.
What happened? Did you start looking for different things, or did they see different virtues in you?
Well, I think because I think so. It was really after, you're right, The Insider that things happened, because The Insider was a hot movie and an important movie, and it was upgraded from the movies I'd been doing. You see, I love the theater, and I stayed in the theater most of my life, and I was a bit snobbish about it. And I made a lot of movies through the 60s, 70s, which were pretty awful. But then most of the movies in the 60s and early 70s were pretty awful. So I so the quality wasn't always there, unfortunately, but the money was. And I was grateful to them for that because I could afford to then do what I wanted to do in the theater.
So films were a way of supporting the habit at that time.
That's right. But I happened to be a sort of leading man looking. And then finally, I was dissipated enough in my 40s to look like a character actor. And that's when everything began to change. And I enjoyed being a character actor because, of course, the roles were so much more interesting. It started with John Huston's film, The Man Who Would Be King, which is a very good film. And certainly after The Insider. Yeah. And now I'm getting nice, lovely scripts like Beginners.
A part for, let's say, a man of some years. Your parts now will be a certain kind of character role. You're not going to get cast as middle-aged men anymore.
Well, I'm determined to. I still look okay.
No, I wasn't. I wasn't expressing my own identity.
I'm in good shape. I could play 60 with ease.
What is the experience like when you finish filming something, put it away, and then you go to a screening room sometime later and you see what it actually looks like all cut together?
Yes, well, the two reactions, either you want to slit your throat, naturally, or you are amazed at what you never dreamed it would look like that. For instance, when I did Up, I did a voice in Up.
Yeah.
I played the bad guy. And you never know what they're going to look like. We didn't see any of the material. It hadn't been done yet. So I recorded the performance. And when I went to see it, I thought, my God, what an absolutely marvelous movie this is. I mean, it really is human. It has everything in it. And that's the sort of thing that surprises you. And that's the pleasant one, when you can't dream of what it's going to look like. And there it is, much more thrilling than you ever dreamed it would be.
My editor and producer joked before the interview began about whether or not we could interview Christopher Plummer without mentioning The Sound of Music at all.
So, well, I guess you can.
I guess we can. There we failed right there.
Right there, yeah.
That aim. Where does it stand? Where does it figure in when you think back on your career? The biggest bill payer of them all, or a wonderful experience? I remember a famous line attributed to you that you referred to it as the sound of mucus throughout making the film.
Well, I think we all kid around about it.
Yes, right.
In my book, I call it S&M, it's an abbreviated version. But, I'm grateful for it because it certainly was famous and put me in the public eye, and I could then help fill a theater full of people when I was doing the great works. It's just that because there were so many nuns around and everything had a sort of air of, I don't know, holier than thou about it, I was determined to play Peck's bad boy.
Yes, it was.
And be the naughty fellow. Well, it needed somebody naughty to keep it away from mawkish sentimentality.
At its time, it was the biggest box office success ever.
Don't make sort of family pictures like that anymore. But it just follows you around a little bit, and people get slightly annoying when they go on and on about it. mothers come up to me in the street. Oh, my children just, oh, gosh, they just never stop watching The Sound of Music. It's just so wonderful. I said, when the hell are they going to grow up, for Christ's sake?
Well, Christopher Plummer, thank you very much. Congratulations on Beginners, and thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Bloom and grow forever, Edelweiss, Edelweiss, bless my homeland forever.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. And the Republican field for next year's election is taking shape with the official announcement of Mitt Romney's candidacy for president. Here to talk politics now are our regular commentators, David Brooks of the New York Times, and joining us from St. Anselm College in Manchester, New Hampshire, E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post. Welcome back, both of you.
Good to be here.
E.J., you were at the Romney announcement yesterday in New Hampshire. He's taking aim at the anemic recovery under the Obama administration. Does he seem to be landing some punches?
Well, I tell you, first of all, it was a beautiful event. There was a big white barn, bales of hay, a sweeping landscape, although apparently it took some federal money to preserve that landscape. And yes, you're right. His message yesterday was much more a general election message focused on the economy and job creation than it was a primary message. And so all that's good news for Romney. A couple of pieces of bad news. One, Sarah Palin and Rudy Giuliani came into the state and stepped all over his message. And Palin's visit to the New Hampshire seashore really seemed to drown out Romney to some degree. The other thing is, once again, we saw his dilemma on health care. That's still going to be a problem for him.
David, there was a Pew poll out yesterday that showed Romney to be well-known and acceptable to a broad part of the electorate. He's been a governor and a business executive. Those are both positive traits, according to that poll. Could this be his year?
It could be, and if the economy's weak, it helps him, obviously, because the first thing it does is it drops health care down the issue ladder and makes the economy the central issue, which is his strongest issue. It's really the only issue on which he's perfectly sincere and authentic, and so that helps him. The thing he has to worry about, his clearest route to the nomination is if Michelle Bachmann does extremely well in Iowa, the entire Republican Party goes into a complete panic, and they run to Mitt Romney. I think that's the likeliest avenue for him. If Michelle Bachmann does not do as well, then he finds himself in a contest really with John Huntsman and Tim Pawlenty. And there it's a much more confused path. Then it really becomes a class-based system where Pawlenty says, I'm the working-class guy. Mitt Romney, you're the guy who supported TARP. You're the guy from Bain Capital. And that becomes a very complicated race for Romney.
You interviewed Pawlenty, the former Minnesota governor, today. Is he saying such things about Mitt Romney? You're the investment banker?
Well, I think he's certainly contrasting his upbringing. He's a working-class kid. Mitt Romney is not. He's certainly going to be attacking Romney on supporting TARP, which Pawlenty did not. Romney did. Aside from that, the issue differences are trivial at best, except for health care. But it's interesting to see a class-based difference emerge on the Republican Party.
E.J., go ahead, E.J., yes.
I think David's right that Bachmann doing well in Iowa would be great for Romney, much as Pat Buchanan doing well in Iowa back in 96 was good for Bob Dole. The one thing I would add to that is wandering around New Hampshire a little bit and talking to Republicans, Huntsman, former Utah Governor John Huntsman, really is working this state hard. He's picked up some pretty, really good Republican activists in New Hampshire for his campaign. And if you look at this, a poll done recently, CNN and WMUR here, Romney is way ahead. Huntsman is a way back, but Pawlenty hasn't gotten anywhere in this state either. And only 4% in this state have definitely decided their vote, according to the poll. So it's very open. And I think Huntsman may be a dark horse with a shot here.
I want to read to you what one commentator said about the Republican field and the Republican Party today. This is a quotation. It's impossible not to hear in the clamor for boldness, for massive cuts in entitlements, a distinctly fevered tone and one with an unmistakable ideological tinge, not the sort of pragmatism that inspires voter confidence. That may sound like E.J., but it's actually the quite conservative Dorothy Rabinowitz of the Wall Street Journal, David. She's asking,
I thought she was very shrewd today.
What does that say about the Republicans?
I think E.J.'s hacking into her word processor there. You know, the Republicans are going to run—
Let's not go there, David.
Yeah, I was tempted. The Republicans are going to run a completely orthodox race. It's going to be they want big government, we want small government, end of story. Yeah. And that will be a completely orthodox Republican-Democratic race. And if the unemployment rate is at 9 or 8.5%, that's a pretty good way to run. And that's simply how they're going to run. This will not be an intellectually interesting race because it's going to be a very conventional Democrat-Republican race.
But will it, EJ, did it sound to you like it might be an optimistic race, a hopeful race about ideas that could make the American economy work better?
Not really. I mean, Romney had in back of him a slogan, Believe in America, which sort of was a combination of hope and change we can believe in. That's hopeful. It was funny when I read that column this morning, Dorothy's column, a Romney person, somebody on the campaign I spoke to yesterday, was emphasizing that he was talking about jobs primarily and not cutting government as the opening shot of the message. So I think as a general election matter, he's very aware of that. But then to me, he stepped on that argument when he said we're only inches away from ceasing to be a free economy. Well, maybe 5.2 quadrillion inches. And it was sort of he's got to do some of that Tea Party rhetoric, even if he wants to do a job message.
David, do you think the Tea Party is going to be decisive for the Republicans this year or next year?
No, I really don't think so. This is going to be an election about national decline. And if the Republicans can say, let's get back to the traditional small government role, that's their message.
David Brooks, E.J. Dionne, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Good to be with you.